Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV Plus. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking season 2, episode 3, titled King and Commoner. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
I liked this episode. I thought the introduction of two major characters, Hober Mallow, you know, what a introduction his character had in terms of just the concept last episode. A warden dying, screaming with his names on his lips, his name inscribed on the vault itself. Instantly appealing, interesting character. Somebody, it's like, why? Like, the whole big question you have is, why the fuck would Harry Seldon want to essentially get Han Solo? Mm-hmm. You know, like, how could Han Solo be the key to anything, right? How could some scoundrel, vagabond, con man, flim flam man be that? And then the other end of the scale of gravitas and importance is General Bell Rios. Mm-hmm. We talked about, like, last season, you know, when they black bagged that poor young woman and sentenced her in eternity to sensory deprivations. Like, wouldn't it be an interesting idea if, like, you know, we visit somebody that gets visited some of these exotic punishments by Empire, and kind of Bell Rios is not that, because clearly he wasn't, you know, memory hold for an entire lifetime. But what, doing 6 years of just the worst kind of labor, thinking that your family's been murdered, and then just out of sheer duty, you come back full knowing that this is such a treacherous institution, a poorly led institution, but you do it for the people. I thought that was a really cool conceit. And then, honestly, I'm mind fucking blown by the end of this. We have a corporeal Harry Seldon again.
Yeah. How's that possible?
Yeah. What did you think of all the twists and turns?
I do really like the two new characters they've introduced. I think they're going to be a lot of fun to watch. I don't know. Something about this episode left me a little cold as compared to the first two. Not that it's bad by any stretch. I still enjoyed it. But yeah, something about the in-between parts of this. And maybe it's because we didn't see much of the, you know, Lee Pace, Cleonic Dynasty stuff that I love so much, because I'm always so excited to see that stuff. And, you know, there's a bit of it here with his interactions with Bell, but it's not the same flavor, right?
That one Dimmerzell scene where it's just sad.
Yeah.
It's just sad and pathetic.
Yeah. And you don't have the exchanging of quips and the tight, you know, smooth dialogue that you get in some of the other scenes. But I did definitely enjoy what I saw. And I'm really excited for these two new characters. I think Hober's introduction is fantastic. This scam artist, who a thief, you know, he's a little bit sillier, but also a little bit more, he seems a little nastier too than a Han Solo. Han Solo might be a mercenary, but this guy seems like he might be willing to hurt people.
Oh, you got that? I guess he was ready to leave those priests. This guy. Just maroon them on this planet where, you know, like that, like you'd seem that they'd probably have, maybe he's not actively malicious, but like careless.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe he doesn't take other people's life and safety very seriously.
He
preserves his own.
He might have been ill used by the Foundation, you know, that you kind of get that hint that he maybe tried to do, like, quote unquote, the right thing, join the priesthood, be this, and that he just, because he's too Hober Mallow, or because the priests are too, you know, stuck on themselves, he couldn't succeed in that, so he just went and formed this parasitic relationship with the... He's a fascinating character. I didn't get a menace from him. This is more of, like, you know, a rascal, but...
Yeah, like a rascal who you can't rely on in any way. I always feel like Han Solo is somehow reliable, you know? He'll at least try and stick to his word. This guy doesn't. I don't get any of that from him. My ass is the only thing I care about.
I said the word rascal, and I know that's how Phoebe Waller-Bridge described her character in the latest Indiana Jones, and that's maybe a better, because, like, yeah, it's she might fuck over Indiana Jones, but also he's Indiana Jones. He'll be all right, you know?
Sure, like, yeah. I'm watching out for myself. Everyone else must be doing the same thing.
Right,
be fine.
Right. Yeah.
But it's a really fun introduction. I don't know, the Titans prick thing really got me.
Dude.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, it's like a form of execution. It's like a Gallagher concert.
Yeah. It's like something out of Idiocracy, right? Like,
no, that's what it
prick is. Yeah.
With they're wearing this ridiculous outfit. I remember like the first time I was watching this, I was like, the execution by the Titans prick. Like, as I was like processing the words, that thing just drops down and obliterates that dude. And I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah.
It was it was a lot of fun. The imagination that they use to come up with some of this shit.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And I gotta say, I'm really liking Salvor a lot more this season. Like, I don't know what it is about Leah Harvey's performance, but it feels a lot more natural this season. It feels like last season she was really either hemmed in by some direction she was getting or something. This season, yeah, she's able to like just feel much more like a real person.
Well, you know, because I've been trying not to say about this because I'm trying not to talk about stuff that I've seen no one else has. But I remember early on in the season, I was a little dismayed that the stiff and kind of wooden quality in the relationship between the two. But as each successive episode went by, I thought it got a little bit more natural and they have a little bit more chemistry. And now I think it's like intentional because like Salvor Hardin is kind of like a homeschooled kid.
Yeah.
Where she was off in this weird backwater thing with a very intense way of living and a very different way of thinking than everybody. And she was raised with like these really outstanding moral principles. And then she's thrust into a world that's in the middle of a crisis. And now she sees a different side of her hero and she's met her and like she's growing up real, real fast.
Yeah. And her performance is really opening up with that. And I am really liking it.
Yeah, that's one of the things we learned last year is like, you know, you Salvor Hardin has this reputation in the books, but, you know, she hasn't quite become that Salvor Hardin yet. And I still don't think that they have finished that arc. But like, it feels intentional now that she is rounding into a more, you know, less naive, less idealistic, but ultimately probably more effective person.
Yeah, no, I like it. And it felt like in the first season, maybe she had a lot of expectations put on her as the warden, right? And she was trying to act that part. And now that she's out of that role, it does feel like she's becoming a more her own person. And I like that a lot. Hopefully she can crack the kind of hard-shelled nut that is Gale. Because Gale, I hope Gale is not one note angry at Harry the entire season. It feels like that's starting to move. We're starting to move past that a little bit with, you know, Salvor kind of pushing her past that.
Well, and she also realizes how much she's owned her kind of impetuousness is. Because, yeah, like Harry should have done a lot of things differently. But honestly, as she's looking back, she probably should have done a lot of things different. Yeah.
So we'll see if that nut is cracked.
There's this potential trinity of Gale, Salvor, and Harry that would probably be pretty entertaining, especially like this you know, slightly mad artificial construct that's now back encased in meat again,
right? What is he gonna be like
and why? Like there's so many mysteries about like, why did he go to this planet?
How
what is
did
the
he
nature
get turned back into a human
of this Kale individual? How do you gin up some kind of apparently human body for this guy to inhabit? I can't wait to see what the answers are.
Yeah, same here. Well, maybe we should get into the recap then.
Yeah. Oh, before we do, this episode was directed by David S. Goyer. Believe the previous episode was written was co-written and directed by David as well. We've talked to him since we started doing this podcast, or since the first podcast came out, and he mentioned that he would be happy to come back to the podcast and talk more Foundation. We, of course, would be thrilled to have him back. He indicated that maybe episode 6 would be a nice little mid-season point for us to catch up, and then maybe we can do another wrap up, answer your guys' questions and stuff. So keep in mind going forward, if you want to put Goyer's name, like G-O-Y-E-R, in the subject line, if you want me to give special attention to anything that you would like to ask him, I can't promise that I'll send everything in. But yeah, if you got a question that strikes our fancy, we'll pass it on. Foundation@baldmove.com if you want to send that in. But yeah, we're you know, again, looking forward to talking, because those conversations were really entertaining. He was a really fascinating guy to talk to, and he's got a lot of passion for this material. So, and I also, I will say that with the strike, things could change on a dime. Like who knows?
Sure,
like
yeah.
Obviously he's not beholden to come on the podcast, and if it would fuck up any of the strike kind of details and stuff, then obviously we'd respect that. Totally understand, because big supporters of the writers and actors unions over here. So yeah, now I think with all that aside, we're ready to get into the episode.
All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Math is never just numbers. This isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation. All right, we start off with Salvor and Gale, and I guess Harry, all arriving at what they think is Ignis. And Gale has a conversation with Salvor where she, you know, wants to believe they can change the future that they saw. Salvor doesn't think they can. And then Harry pilots them down to the surface of this desert planet with abandoned mines. It's not Ignis. In fact, what is the name of this planet?
Una's world,
right. An imperial mining site that has been exhausted and abandoned 3,000 years ago. Gale and Salvor want to know what the fuck. The Prime Radiant wanted him to come here and visit some place in the mountains, and he needs him to transport the Radiant up there. And Gale doesn't want to do it, but Salvor convinces her to.
Yeah, I like, this one thing I talked to Mr. Goyer last year is like, are you familiar with the Warhammer franchise at all? Because they keep on some of these details, like the idea that they have completely exhausted a world and then left the renegade mining equipment to just decimate the population is something the Imperium of Man would do. And it's like one of those like, yeah, it's chilling. The idea that you could suck a world dry. And then the last act of the mining equipment as it grinds the people's blood and bones, the paste or something, is just so, you know, grimdark.
Is that, I like it. Is that a mercy killing? Because their planet is now a barren husk that won't support life? Is that...
I don't know.
There's
read an excerpt from a story set place in the Warhammer universe where they talk about this, you know, this industrial world where they've taken all its oceans, all of its mineral worth, none of the animals that used to be there extinct. It's irradiated and inhospitable, and nothing can grow there. And like the Imperium is like pulling up stakes, and their like last announcement to the population is, "Congratulations, you no longer have to tie this anything." You know, in fact, we're gonna let you gracefully exit the Imperium, which is like the population is briefly excited by, but then they realize that like that all the starships are leaving, and there's going to be several billion people on the planet with no water, no food, hardly any air, and it's just like, you know, like, ooh, what if you want to? But yeah, I guess it would be like the mining equipment killing you fast would be better than almost, slowly starving or asphyxiating to death. Yeah.
And this is not the first planet we've seen them do this to. We start out with the clerics visiting another planet this has happened on, right? This is systematic. And so, you know, for a dynasty that's supposed to last into eternity, it feels very short-sighted. They're not even attempting any form of renewability with their mining operations. They're simply, well, I guess this is 3,000 years ago, so it wasn't the Cleonic dynasty. It was before that. But they're very much, you know, the Outer Reach might be picking off planets, but they're also decimating their own planets and diminishing their empire that way, right? Like later, what Bell is saying about, you know, an empire's lifeblood is also the planets. Well, it's using up its own lifeblood and discarding it.
It's like you're eating yourself, you know?
Yeah, it's very cannibalistic.
I also like there's this subtle thing that going on with Gale and Salvor. Like Salvor's annoyed by Gale trying to like, oh no, we'll find a way to avoid the fate, and that she calls it like, you don't even believe that, you know. I thought that was really interesting because a video I saw, there's a psychologist talking, or I think it's a relational therapist talking about there's a phenomenon that happens in couples where one of them gets like a diagnosis that is like a fatal disease, like you're going to get cancer, and like you both of them in the beginning are like, well, we're just going to beat this, and you're not going to die, and we're going to get through this and everything, and like sometimes that goes great for the couple and you go in and beat in remission, but for the people that are not so lucky, at some point you both have to recognize that the other person is going to die, or it actually is a gulf, a widening gulf will divide you, because there's like a very basic fact of your existence that you're in denial about, and it will paradoxically rob you of the intimacy of your last few months or years that you could spend, you know, but you're in denial, so you can't. And I wonder if they're like, you know, playing around with that idea that, you know, Salvor's ready to die. She's ready to meet her destiny, and Gale's not. Is she going to, like, how much time is she going to waste trying to save or trying to avoid the inevitable, like Harry says? Or it could be that they figure out a way to save Salvor, and all this is meaningless. But I couldn't help but think of that video I just watched, and, like, if this is inevitable, then anything they're trying to do to prevent it is a waste of time, and also probably going to divide Salvor and Gale.
Because
Gale paradoxically, or I'm sorry, Salvor's is she says she's never felt more alive, because she knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's nothing she could do to die today.
Yeah.
Like, the good thing about knowing you're going to die for certain at some time in the future is that you know it's not going to be today. So
imagine the risks you can take.
Yeah.
And then there's the Harry side of this, where he's talking about this memory that Gale has, and he says, you know, he thinks it's inevitable. He says there are an infinite number of ways to arrive at the inevitable, and But he also says some other things in this episode that I find interesting in that context, where he is kind of diminishing his own role within his own plan. Later in the episode, he's talking about how even at the right scales, even I become insignificant. even though he's the architect of the whole plan, and I wonder how those things kind of mesh together.
Well, especially since in the books that felt very much right, that Harry eventually, you know, he starts this thing, but like, you know, the elegance of the plan in Psycho History was that it unfolds without his direct involvement.
Except clearly, he's that's pulling not the... strings in the current. You know, he talks about how, oh, I'm pulling some very small strings here, making very small changes in the current to affect the future.
But now you got multiple Harrys rolling around. One is flesh and blood again. Like, does his role diminish if he just never goes away?
It's a good question. I mean, potentially he could die now also, right?
Well, one of them.
This version of Harry, yeah.
Yeah, and is there going to be a war? Okay, we talked about this, like, is there going to be conflict between the two Harrys? Well, now one's synthetic and one is flesh and blood. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be a rift, you know?
It might make him less powerful, you know?
True.
I mean, we've seen what the vault can do, right?
Yeah, I mean, if I could choose flesh and blood versus immortal computer matrix, I'd pick an immortal computer matrix every time.
Same here.
Just hoping I can find someone to carry my prime rating around so I can go places, but...
yeah. Take me on this roller coaster. I want to feel it. So on Terminus, the director's council tries to figure out the meaning of the vault killing the warden. But there's a big argument, you know, Polly and him are butting heads, but he manages to convince them to find Hober Mallow.
I wonder what Salver would know that there's a crystal bust of her in the, you know, the high council meeting room or whatever of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is like a minor prophet now.
Yeah. And I want to see how many more of those crystal busts we're going to get over the years. Is Hober Mallow going to get his own if he becomes... I don't know. Is the warden going to get his own? The one that just burned alive? I doubt it. But Hober Mallow might.
Yeah.
There's also a small moment in here where the director is pouring drinks for everyone. And he offers a drink to Polly. And I look at that and I'm like, They made a big deal about his drinking in the last episode. Is this the director kind of trying to sideline Polly to get him to indulge and him not be able to be an effective voice against what the director wants to do?
Yeah, no, that seems like... Yeah, you're leaning into something that they're struggling with, that's making them less effective, that's probably dulling them, not making them as sharp as they could or should be.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's a pretty shitty thing to do, but this guy seems shitty.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain ruthlessness to the Foundation. You know, like this guy, you know, the first episode when he's talking about War of the Empire, it's like he can barely, he's like, oh, I can't wait. We're ready for it. Like... It's hard to believe a director of Foundation would ever be excited about open war, you know? Like, it might be inevitable, but why would you, like, lick your chops about it?
Yeah, it's going to be costly no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I do wonder if, you know, the guy eventually agrees, like, okay, go out and find Hober Mallow. But I think there's an opportunity here for bad things to happen while Polly's gone. Because Polly is the only voice in this room looking to find Hober Mallow. I wonder if the director is going to try anything with the vault while he's gone.
More people want to die screaming. They have this like whole line of armed wardens cordoning off the vault. So it's like, I don't know if they're going to try anything. But then again, if Polly and
put
Constant...
a different plan into motion, because he's not on board with the Hober Mallow gambit, which I don't know what the alternative is, right? Like.
And I totally understand now, having met Hober Mallow, why he would be skeptical to put a scoundrel, a rascal, why he would want to insert that into the vault and just see what happens, you know. And there's also like you could, you know, like someone said, it could be a warning.
Yeah, he says get Hober Mallow. What is that warning? I didn't buy that argument.
Yeah.
That seemed thin. Anyway, Polly tells Brother Constant what he knows about Hober Mallow and then says, we're going to Corel to find him. And they take off.
Yeah, he's a species of nut, trained by the priest of Foundation for missionary work, but he was just too much. Mm-hmm. Instead, he trailed the missionary fleets selling fake relics. Like, he was arrested after selling 38 finger bones from Harry Seldon. That a joke that that's actually more than you could actually have finger bones? I don't know that it is. Because you got like three on every finger, right? So you have at least 30? Oh, yeah, that's right. So you could.
Yeah, 38.
So, that's too many. That'd be too many. And the thumbs only have two. So,
yeah.
Maybe he's counting tarsals and metatarsals.
Sure. I don't know. There could be 50 bones in each of my fingers. I wouldn't know.
And, you know, leads the question of like, well, why would the prophet choose him? And Polly kind of wryly observes that the prophet had a sense of humor, and maybe it's some of that. But also, yeah. There's some admirable qualities, like saying that someone views a prohibition as a personal challenge. Yeah, if someone tries to restrict someone, or someone says something's forbidden or you shouldn't mm-hmm. do that, someone questioning, like I think you could be an asshole by questioning too much, and after you've given a good reason doing it anyway, you could be selfish and self-destructive, but not necessarily. That's another way of saying someone's curious and inquisitive. And is not stopped easily by social pressures or things like that. You could see that would be very valuable for dealing with, you know, these guys like the Commodore. And the Foundation also, I'll put it out there, not above tricking and flim-flamming populations already. So maybe you need...
Harry himself is a little bit like that.
Maybe a con man at the top is the right man for the job.
Yeah, my notes say, if it's forbidden, Hobart traffic's in it. Sounds like a fun guy. Yeah, I could see it. And he definitely is a fun guy. We'll see later.
I really like the space folding effect that they have in this little, the spirit, their little ship. It looks like it rips like a thin line in the fabric of space-time and kind of slips into it. It's a lot less kinetic than the Imperial tech we saw from last year. It feels a little bit more efficient and elegant. And I don't know whether they're going for that or if that's just like a slightly different take on the jump drive effect, but I thought it was cool.
Yeah, and then when they jump, when they get to their destination, I noticed this last episode, it kind of has a line that comes off at the forms into a wisp of like some gas or something.
Yeah, there's like
just dissipates.
The lines, there's like some kind of thing that's like drawing the line out or something.
Yeah. It's cool looking.
It is very cool. Just this ship taking off into the night sky I thought was lovely.
All right, we're back on Una's world. Una's world? God, that feels wrong to me because of Star Trek right now, but
yeah, it's Una Chin Riley. there's a long lost 15,000 year connection between this and Star Trek Strange New World.
Gail walks Harry out to the mountains as he tells her about this planet. He also tells her that she likely can't change the future, and they argue about it for a while, and they arrive at a cave entrance and head up a massive statue toward what Harry describes as an old friend.
You know what's fucking sick about this scene that I only realized on the second time watching it? Harry Seldon doesn't leave footprints in the sand.
Oh, nice.
Him and
Gale
are watching right next to each other, and it's like Legolas and Lord of the Rings, where it's just like he's not sinking. And I don't, because like some of it looked practical. They actually zoom in on his feet as they approach the tunnel, and it looks like Jerry Harry is walking on solid ground, but it's still like it's nifty. It's airtight, and it's one of those little things. It's just, of course he wouldn't leave footprints.
Yeah,
but
he's all digital.
It's subtle, but it's really, really uncanny when you actually look at it and like rewind, like, wow, how did they, it's a nice effect.
I guess he doesn't walk anywhere once he's human in this, right? So you couldn't say, oh, did they remember to put the footprints in once he becomes
human
again?
He doesn't actually walk on sand with his flesh and blood. But,
yeah, he's lifted into the air.
This is where Gail gets a little bit of the chip knocked off of her shoulder, you know, where he, you know, she's trying to say like, well, what's the difference between what you're wanting to do, what I want to do? And he's got an answer for that. And then she's like, well, you're the one that didn't even leave a psychohistorian behind. He's like, I meant to, you know, you were supposed to be like, who knows, in an alternate universe, you could have guided Sal for, and you know, who knows what she would be at this point. And he kind of like lands a couple points that hit home for her.
Yeah, but it's all really Raish's fault. I mean, that's the thing.
Which
is
another way
he's saying about Gale really should be aimed at Raish, but he's dead, so you
and
can't.
Also ultimately, like, how does Harry dodge these criticisms too, because ultimately this is his plan. And you know, he knows more than anybody. You can't rely on single individuals to do things. So, like, why were all these single points of failures there, Harry? Or are there? Who knows?
Yeah, we don't know. An infinite number of ways to arrive at the inevitable.
I like the line that he has that the emperors are hollow men who rule over hollow worlds. That was, you know, like, how many of the imperial planets are these dead worlds, too? Like,
Do they still count these as...
I imagine they count them, but I bet this isn't what is on the galactic news. You know, how many of these sucked out worlds that they've got. They used to be like, you know, have these cities and these statues and thriving industrial time. There's
monuments to industry, I think, is what he calls these statues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which at this point is kind of a cruel joke, right? The monument to the industry that completely ruined their planet, killed everyone on it.
Elaborate tombstones to the populace.
Yeah.
Oh, the other cool thing is, like, Harry's also not sweating. Like, you'll see that Gail is, like, her suit is dripped in sweat, and is, like, Harry's clothes are perfectly dry, never has any sweat on him. He's not leaving footprints. Obviously he's a hologram, but it's, I like that as attention to detail.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we go over to Lepsis Penal Colony, where one of the workers stops working, so he's killed by a guard. A guy goes over to try and help him out, and then Dimmerzell lands, and turns out this guy is Bel Rios. She gives him an offer to lead the fleet. If he completes it, he can go free, and he tries to negotiate a little bit of a better deal for him and his fellow prisoners, and he does. And then the thing that really seals the deal is that Dimmerzell offers to reconnect him with his husband, who he thought was executed 6 years ago. That the guy's name is Glawin Kerr, I think. I have no subtitles, but it sounds like Glawin.
Yeah, he calls him Clay at one point in the episode.
Oh, Clay? Okay.
I think that I don't understand why Bel, a lot of what Bel Rios does in this episode, I think, tracks. But ultimately, I don't understand why he thinks the Empire will keep any deal that he makes with him. Like, I'm surprised that Dimmerzell pushes back against the freeing everybody, because I don't think, like, you know, what are they're going to let these guys have slightly longer breaks. Like, what? I don't believe that for a second. I believe that if Bel Rios completes whatever mission the Empire has him set out to do, that he will be beheaded on his arrival and as thanks. Like, but I guess if you believe to your bones and what Bel Rios is saying here, that, like, that all might come to pass, but I can still save some people. I can still protect some people. Maybe that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I think Dimmerzell pushing back is kind of smart, right? Because if she offers him everything he wants without a moment's hesitation, I think he worries a little bit more about, you know, the outcome of this plan.
But I just don't think he's a stupid enough to think that the Empire is going to keep his world. I mean,
no, he seems very smart.
Yeah, he's like, his leadership is capricious and unwise, therefore he can be trusted. That's not where that. And he's also ballsy. Like, you know, he's they've already taken everything from him in his mind, and Dimmerzell calls back and says it's time to lead your troops again, and he's leading off with his anti-day rhetoric.
Yeah, he's got nothing to lose, I guess. I mean, I guess at worst, he's taken out of the labor camp and, yeah.
Right.
Gets to spend his last days on his ship with his old crew, right?
Yeah. But they're definitely showing this is a good man. This is a capable man. Yeah. This is a man that cares about people. You know, even this old man who's almost used up, he's trying to save. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, loyal to the Empire in the sense of its people, not necessarily capital E Empire.
Yeah, and true to his word, he's honest. He seems to have many very good qualities, let's say.
Lawful good, is this what this guy's whole thing is?
But not 100% lawful good, because he will disobey an order from time to time if he thinks it's in the best interest of the Empire.
Mm-hmm. Guy's a little laws of humanity that he's following.
Oh yeah, his three rules of,
got to be loyal to the Empire, human, but you can't allow through inaction or action imperial citizens to come to harm.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
All right, Gale and Harry continue to a door with seemingly no way in. They do figure out how to open it, though, and find Kale on the other side. Harry tells Gale to go back to the ship and leave if she doesn't hear from him in 6 hours. And he enters the chamber and the door closes, locking her out. Open a wall, it becomes a door. That's a hilarious line to me. I don't know why. It's the term open a wall. Honestly, it becomes a hole. Whether it's a door or not, I think is debatable, but yeah.
What's your feeling about this Kale?
My feeling?
Is this a real person?
Well, I mean, inside the Prime Radiant, I thought it was the representation of the consciousness of the Prime Radiant. I wonder what's happened here. Is this something where the Prime Radiant, being in close proximity to this facility, whatever it is, already transfers out the consciousness of the Prime Radiant into this facility? And that's why we're seeing Kale? Or is this something where Kale is maybe flesh and blood out here waiting to meet Harry at a designated time? Or is another copy of Kale, or the real copy of Kale? There are so many possibilities here. It's impossible to really know yet.
Yeah, and Harry drops the name of Alana, his life partner that also understands the Prime Radiant. I wonder if one fun storyline to explore would be like, what if there are multiple fathers and mothers of the Prime Meridian that were in on it with Harry and have committed their consciousness to some kind of digital form?
Could be, yeah.
And that they're like I don't know to what end, because I don't know what that adds or does to the story, but like I thought Kale existed a long time ago. I thought it was I remembered from the first season, that she was long dead, only her writings are left behind.
So it's probably not a physical human Kale.
But to answer your question directly, I don't think the Prime Radiant went there and then Kale sprang forth from it and opened the door. I think the Prime Radiant was drawn to this location and met a presence that opened the door that was Kale. That's how I took it.
Okay. Is this Kale just another representation of an artificial intelligence? Is that just how they manifest? These are two different artificial intelligences representing in the same way?
My feeling is yes. Yeah, because she says, what does she say? I have the means to sustain a digital form. I have the means to keep a pure digital form in existence. Like, but why would you? Unless you yourself, you know, why in this abandoned planet, why would you have a system to maintain holographic beings unless, yeah, I think so. And also,
well, doesn't
Gale
say
only
something?
Got one life sign at the end, even though we know Kale was standing right there. So, like, I think
so
that's
not
pretty,
human, yeah.
Pretty good evidence that she's not a biological life form.
I don't know. I've seen enough Star Trek to know that you can't scan through most caves.
True. So. That statue was made out of anti-Corbinite that famously reflects bioscans. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm kidding with that, but you're probably right. That's not a real person. I lost what I was going to say about Harry, because he says something interesting in one of these scenes about her, but maybe I'll remember it later. Anyway, let's go over to Corel, where Hober Mallow manages to steal a precious jewel from a dignitary whose name I think is Condor Argus. But he doesn't get out of the area in time and he gets arrested. This is a really cool scene. Great introduction to this character. I am really surprised that the tech that they're showing off here actually works. This bracelet, well, what seems to be a bracelet that can swap places of two people wearing
a castling device. I love the name too.
Yeah. Yeah. Where, you know, if you're not familiar in chess, if you have direct line of sight between your rook and your king, you can.
And they haven't
not
moved.
Exactly.
They haven't moved yet.
And they haven't moved yet. You can not exactly, but more or less swap places with them.
Yeah. I wonder if, because the first thing I thought of is this is an elaborate trick. Like,
yeah,
when you look at it, it almost looks like a hologram is covering the Condor when he turns into it. But like, the more when I watch this more times, it's like, no, I actually think they switched places. Mm-hmm. So at least some kind of short point to point teleportation is that. But that doesn't surprise me. Why would that surprise me?
No, technologically, I guess it doesn't. But
we haven't seen it before yet, though.
It was something new, definitely. It's really cool, and I wonder how it could be used in the future. Cleverly,
it could be a way for a darkness to escape being obliterated.
A darkness to escape being
obliterated. Yeah, you know, Brother Darkness, when he's about to be disintegrated by the particle beam, if he had one of those bracelets,
dust.
He could.
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's what he becomes, Brother Darkness, as soon as he starts to walk towards the portal at that little handoff ceremony when there's briefly four of them.
Gotcha.
But like, I think that might be a cool application. Like, if this Day, who seems like he thinks he is an individual more than the others, like, I could see him trying to duck it. And I don't know if Demerzel would be like you could, like, he could castle like one of the decanted clones in there at the last minute.
Yeah, or one of the maybe decant the clone and castle in one of the less desirable brothers.
Yeah, yeah, you know? The former Brother Don. I think that's the one that jumps to my mind. Because yeah, otherwise, I'm gonna be looking at Hobermalo going forward for some castling possibilities here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's just it's a fun scene, and Hobermalo seems like a slippery guy you want to keep an eye on.
I thought it's funny in that we go into the David S. Goyer of this show, is I noticed that in the long list of atrocities you could use for this technology for, they mentioned sewing bombs into prisoners. Goyer is one of the credited writers on The Dark Knight, which features the Joker sewing a bomb into a prisoner. And I'm wondering if that's like a little like, wink, you know? In which case, I saw it. I got the wink. Our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
The algorithm says the podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation.
All right, Dimmerzell gives Bell a chamber in which to clean himself up, but he wants to be a disgusting mess when he appears before Day, and he does that. Day gives him his mission to find out if the Foundation is a threat to Empire, and he asks to speak frankly and privately with Day, and when he does, it's a lot of insults. He refuses to go as far as striking Day, even though he's goaded on by Day, and not even when he threatens his husband, because he took an oath to protect Empire. And so Day leaves and Bell is reunited with his husband. Every show does this, so I'm not picking on the people writing this show, but it's a pet peeve of mine.
Uh-oh.
Where the person in charge of the guards gives a direct order. Kill this man. Take this man out of this room, back to prison, and kill his husband.
Oh, yeah.
And Bell makes one move and says one word and the guards stop, right? Yeah. They ignore the order that their emperor just gave them, as if the bad guy saying something is more important, or the nemesis saying something.
It's probably a little bit of discretion in a royal guard where, you know, the guy goes, wait, and you kill him, and then the emperor's like, I would like to have heard what he said. It's like...
Sure,
a brief hesitation,
but you gave me a direct order. I'm following
you. You're right.
It's a huge trope, and it happens everywhere. I see it all the time. It's just one of my bugaboos.
It's kind of crazy how singular Day is running this thing. Like, he keeps dismissing his brothers from her private conversations and whatnot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, like, we talked last episode how, I think we did anyway, that Bell Rios is this general, and, you know, the one of the inspirations for Foundation is the fall and rise and decline of the Roman Empire. And, you know, that was one of the Empire's problems, right? That, you know, in any general that was good at his job was a potential existential threat to the state. So you had this tension between you need effective conquerors to maintain your empire, but also if they get too effective, they can just throw over the whole apple cart.
And there's something to that effect, either in this scene or later in this episode, where they say, oh, when you'll be given your old post or whatever, and you'll be given your old fleet. And he's like, yeah, I will. Your old fleet is still loyal to you, and you're like, yeah, they are, or something like that.
Well, he's like, you know, because he's talking about how the Empire demands respect. It requires, like, oxygen to breathe. He goes, well, you also need planetary systems, which means you need my fleet. And he's like, it's not your fleet. And he's like, the fuck if it isn't.
And yeah.
He's right, because, like, the second this fucker gets back on the bridge, everybody is giving him the, you know, the claps on the back, and it's like, it feels very much like Maximus from Gladiator, right?
Absolutely, like, yeah. They're as loyal to him as they are to the Empire.
Even years later, they think he's dead. Like, if Maximus returns and his legions are ready to fight for him, and you get the idea that these are the same way.
Yep.
Like the horn of dilemma he gives him. It's like, yes. He goes, strike me. It's like, and which are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to strike me so I know I have effective control over you? Or are you supposed to not, to show that you'll protect the Empire at all costs? What's the right answer? Mm-hmm. And he gives the correct one, which is, I guess, the correct one, which is, I took an oath not to hit Empire. And that's all there is to it.
Loyal to my oath at all costs.
And I like how Lee played this, where, like, there's this, like, slight smile that spreads over his face, but then I don't know, it just feels like a very Scorpion and the Frog situation on both sides. And even you'll see, like, you know, Day being very petulant in the next scene with Demerzel about this too. So, like, even though it feels like a triumph here, it doesn't feel like a triumph to him even moments later.
Well, I like the way that this choice he gives him resolves itself, because it feels honestly like the only call you could make. The Emperor has one card to play. If it doesn't go, if he makes the other choice, right, he can play that card one time. He can say, all right, well, I'm killing your husband. Boom, he's dead. That card is played. And now you have no leverage over the guy. Whereas if he is loyal specifically to his oath to Empire, you play that card as many times as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, that's the only choice to make here, right?
Yeah.
And I really like his line when he's kind of reasoning through this. An Emperor is trying to goad him into making the wrong choice. He says, I'll not strike my Emperor, not even for your husband's life. And he said, my husband's been dead 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, kind of using his own actions, his own cruelty against him in that moment.
Right.
I love it.
And also, like, I don't even know that he's not dead. You know, you're saying he's behind this door, which makes the next scene very powerful of their reunion.
Yes. Yeah, it is. This tearful reunion is very powerful, especially, you know, the way he's so standoffish. And you see it from the very beginning of the scene. He doesn't run up and try and hug him and kiss him and, like, he's very standoffish because it's been 6 years. He doesn't know what they've told him, his husband, about him while he's been gone. He looks like he looks. He smells like he smells. He doesn't want this to be the reunion interaction that they have any more than it needs to be, right?
Yeah,
he's
going to
go clean up in a scene later.
I thought this was, because I could see, like, couples in this situation in modern times, like, behavior, like, where you're approaching trembling, and, like, then when you actually make physical touch, like, the fact that it's real, this is really happening, like, overcomes you with emotion. But in this era where, as far as he knows, this could be a hologram, this could be someone dressed like, that physical touch, so I've seen that this is something real, a warm living, like, it's like a double confirmation. And clearly the physical touch is such a big thing to him, and his husband wants to hug him, but he also is so proud that he's like, I'm not ready for this because I'm still a prisoner with bad teeth and lice. I want to meet you as your actual husband. And there's this really tender scene of them, you know, him showering and his husband cutting his hair and giving him a a beard, and the course of this revealing his, I guess, Imperial brand. I wonder how, like, is every person in the Imperial Navy get this branded on the back of the neck, or is this just for, like, generals or something? Or is this, like, a voluntary thing he did, like a tattoo?
No, I assume this is a prison camp, a labor camp thing.
Really?
This is a punishment. I don't think this is part of
the military. I took this as, like, you know, the SPQR type things that all the Roman legionnaires got, you know, as tattoos
maybe,
or something, is like a solidarity thing. But in the back,
because what he says later about, you know, those decisions kind of leaving a scar on you, and then, you know, he touches the back of his neck where that brand is.
It could be.
I think that's what they're getting at. You don't notice it before he cleans up, but there's a pretty big age disparity between these guys. I would say Bell is maybe 20 years older or so than Glaewyn. I think that's his name.
I didn't catch that, I guess.
Pretty sure. I don't know if they're, like, trying to do anything with that, but we'll see, I guess, as this relationship becomes clearer, comes more into focus.
Okay.
And during that scene where they're cleaning up, you've also got Demerzel and Day, like, spying on them.
And Day is just really in the grips of this existential doubt, where he has got the result that he sought out and wanted after Demerzel convinced him. But he's like, is this good policy? Is it the echo of good policy? Is it the genetic sense memory of good policy? Like, if any of my thoughts and actions my own? And I think it's also interesting when, like, Demerzel tries to soothe and, you know, says, you're fine, you're doing well, you're Empire. And he's like, keep going. The look on her face is, oh, Jesus, this is a mess.
Yeah.
It's not a look of, you know, the in last season, the Kleons, even as they were declining, like it seems like she had a lot of affection for them, like they were her children or, you know, at the very least pets or something. This is not, it doesn't look like she's got that same feeling about this particular Kleon.
Yeah, even as it seems she's like forced she's losing to, faith in him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, could be pretty bad for this Kleon. We saw what happened last season with Brother Dawn, who got out of line. Mm-hmm. There might be some consequences for Brother Day here, but we'll see.
Snappy, snappy. Mm-hmm. But you never know, because I also, it could be that she's this, I could also interpret this as guilt, you know, because like we had that one email, it's like, well, how do we know that Demerzel's loyal to the Empire? Like, what if she's behind this degradation and she's like, oh, you guys, you just didn't have a chance because I've cut the legs, genetic legs out from underneath the young man. And she's like, you know, like resolute, but also regretful that she's having to do this, the people she cares about. That's another way you could interpret it. But all the Imperial stuff remains fascinating.
We go back to Gale making it back to her ship and she tells Salvor about what happened. They talk about Harry and how Gale doesn't really want to abandon him. And Salvor asks, what would Harry do? And Gale says he'd fucking leave. So I guess they're determined to leave him if he doesn't respond in 6 hours.
I thought it was interesting that Gale's father, not Gale, Salvor's father said, you can never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what's right. Mm-hmm. That scene is a Sphinxian riddle. What? Like,
it's basically saying go with your gut, right?
But
is what that boils down to?
We're talking about doing what's right. What informs your sense of right other than your morals?
Your gut. She's getting so caught up in the puzzling out the morality of each choice that she's not going with what she feels, I think is what that means. And in her gut, she says, We should fucking leave him, right?
Yeah, I can see, like, if you say don't let your sense of duty, don't let your sense of justice, don't let your sense. But even then, that's like, those are like words where it's like, I don't see how pursuing, you know, I could. Because it all goes back to like, yeah, like what you got morals and ethics, and like ethics are like applied morality. So it's like, I just thought this was an interesting way to construct it. But yeah, if you're saying that, like, you know, don't get Chidi from The Good Place would be a good example of someone's morals preventing him from doing the right thing just because he's paralyzed by analysis and through inaction doing a lot of bad things. So maybe that's what it is. Cause yeah, he's the poster child for morality interfering with doing the right thing.
Absolutely. All right, let's move over to Polly and Constant arriving on Corel, where they find Hober Mallow up for execution by Titan's Prick.
By the Titan's Prick.
Polly tries to use his status as cleric to postpone his death, but it's no use. Instead, Hober's got his own plan. He manages to swap places with Argus on the execution block and make it out to Polly's ship, and he takes off just as Polly and Constant jump aboard. They kick him out of the pilot seat and drug him into submission as they head back to Terminus.
I will say that I saw this coming a mile away because, you know, I saw him pull that thing off the cuff before they take him into custody. I'm like, oh, this is, and then when they put a mask on his face, I'm like, oh, there's the Commodore. It's going to end up in that there Giant's Prick seat. And he sure does. And I actually thought that he was going to die.
Me too.
I'm like, oh, wow. That's going to be fucking wild. But
then you'd be chased to the ends of the Empire, right? Like, that's a bridge too far. Escaping is one thing. Murdering the...
Yeah.
You can't get away with that.
Yeah. And, like, some of these things, like, again, I have hazy memories of the books, but I'm pretty sure this Coral, like, there's more plot to deal with this particular planet. I know Rios was an important character in the end of the first or maybe the early goings of the second book. So, yeah, they're definitely continue to playing jazz with the material because they're interweaving these, you know, Hober Mallow, again, as a named character. Yeah, I'm very curious to see how, because, you know, what the patterns from previous season is that these people are going to be changed and expanded greatly you know, mm-hmm. from being like a couple paragraphs to, you know, potentially seasons long. So, I think this planet looks funny. I like the enforcers. Mm-hmm. I like this, the style.
I love, Hober, man. He's, when he's giving his big speech about his last words, right? And he's like, oh, it's a shame that we never got the opportunity to sit down and as friends and talk and maybe mm-hmm. charm enemies into new friends. And he looks over at the guard mm-hmm. who's like running the execution operation. And she's right. like, mm-hmm. no, but you know, there's a certain charm to him. Maybe that would be possible.
I thought that these, the government officials look like they are the naval troops from the Fifth Element.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, it has like that kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The president most of that movie, right?
I thought the Commodore looks very much like, the presidential advisor that kind of pervs on Lilo at the beginning.
Suits his character. There's a very like big Star Wars vibe in these uniforms. The Imperial officers, I think.
Very, very, you know, militaristic, authoritarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly the kind of thing that Hober might want to get one over on.
Yeah. And you can see, like, Brother Constance is a little attracted to him. Like, she likes his confidence, and he's like, oh, he's confident. And Polly's like, he's appalling. And then as they realize, like, oh, my God, he knows we have a jump ship. He's going to try to steal it. And they're like... barely make it on board. Mm-hmm. I really like the ship. I'm really a sucker for variable geometry ships that, like, you know, I don't know, maybe because I grew up in an era where all the coolest airplanes had the swing, you know, swept wing, swing wing, F-14 kind of things going for them. But I do love a ship that does a little bit of transforming when it gets ready to fly.
All right, Glaywin suggests to Bell that they run from the Empire. He refuses because he has to protect everyone from Empire's poor decisions. Glaywin gives him a necklace with a pendant and calls him General, and they fly out to a ring of Trantor where he's reunited with his old crew, and they jump toward the Outer Reach.
What do you think is going on with this necklace? It's a badge of office. Does it actually do anything else?
I assumed it's just representative of his station, but I don't know. I don't know.
So this is just, that's just that. It's just kind of like a welcome back, General. It's not.
I think.
Anytime I see a gadget being handed to somebody with an inset shot, I think, oh, this is something to remember for the future. Yeah.
It very well could be.
But also could, like you said.
I don't know if it has an inscription that'll be important in an Indiana Jones kind of way later. Who knows?
He's going to have to put it on a 2-meter staff.
Uh-huh.
Go to Cleon's bathtub and put it into the drain on the solstice of Trantor. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
But yeah, he's like this, like, where, you know, his husband's trying to make, like, hey, you know, now we got our fleet back. Why don't we just fuck off?
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, you got the loyalty, the people do it. And he's like, look, I'm not a revolutionary. And as much as I'm a revolutionary, I'm even less of a deserter. Because the fact is, there's all these trillions of people that the Emperor thinks is disposable, and I'm the one man that isn't. And because of that, my duty is to protect all those other trillions. Now, this seems wretchedly naive, but I want it to not be.
That he could do anything to protect these people?
That he's going to be able to do something to protect the people and outsmart Cleon and be able to... rein in the worst of Cleon's impulses while he protects, while he is faithful to Emperor. It seems like that's just wishing, that's just whistling past a graveyard.
Wishful thinking for sure.
But
what's the alternative here, right? He's fiercely loyal to his oath and to the people that he wants to protect. He's got to at least try.
Yeah, they did some interesting world building here, which I think the show does so well. Like the salute, the Imperial Naval salute is essentially an inverted Klingon salute with like tapping the insignia of the Empire in their heart. I thought that was cool. I like the spacer teasing the general about being space sick. And that they have, like, you can see that this is like a crew on the verge of mutiny, because even the spacers like recognizing the way they all suffer under the Emperor's heel. you know, that they're all controlled. None of them are trusted. None of them are valued or treasured. And then, yeah, they jump off with a big ass fleet. What is there, 20 ships in this?
That's a lot of them. Yeah.
More.
I was wondering, I don't know if you saw this very closely or looked at it, but are the jump ships slightly modified now? Do they look a little more, they looked a little more Star Warsy to me, a little more Imperial Star Destroyer.
It looked like they were the same
covered kind of things, but maybe not.
It looked like they're the same basic plan, the kind of knife shape with the offset core and one end of it that was, but I noticed, like, I don't think the, and maybe there's a difference in civilian and military, because, like, I think they've slightly changed the jump effects.
Okay.
Or maybe those are just the civilian liners that do the really fancy jump that we saw last year in the first episode. But they might be a little sleeker, maybe a little bit more metallic looking.
It felt like there was
slight
something
aesthetic
else going
differences.
On. Or maybe more lighting coming off of them. I'm not sure. Because they've had several versions of that jump ship. I mean,
And it's 160 some years later. So even if we talk about this, we talk about the technological stasis, but that doesn't mean that, like, the, you know, that the designers wouldn't, like, update the keep it up at the current aesthetics of the time or
totally. But even in the old timeline, 100 something years ago, we had multiple versions. You had the Emperor's kind of personal jump ship, the Rubicon, which looked slightly different from, you know, the civilian ones, slightly different, from the military
cruisers,
ones. Yeah.
Which looked different from the Invictus. So,
yeah. No, they really, like, spare no expense when it comes to the design of these ships. They they take great care. Like you said, they sweat the details in the show.
Yeah. And it all says something about, you know, like, you can get an idea of, like, the society from the design of the things that they use and the clothes they wear. And I like that.
It feels a bit like what they did with the Expanse, with the Rocinante over the course of that show.
How so?
Where they just kept, you know, they'd go on a mission where they needed to add gas tanks to it or something.
Yeah.
And then those
or
would just kind of hang
rail
around
gun
for
and
a season or two.
Now we got the landing legs and it just kept
now we
on
got the
getting
armor.
Yeah.
It feels like that, where we're evolving as the time moves on, right? Because, of course, things in our world don't stay the same aesthetically, even if they're the same functionally, right? Like, look at a toaster in 1950, look at a toaster in 2020. It's crazy different.
Yeah.
Aesthetically, but still performs the exact same function. So,
yeah, because, like, toaster technology is not in, like,
no, it's in stasis.
Have you looked at the inside of one? It's just a fucking coil, metal coil that's got too much resistance. It gets hot.
Yep. Yeah.
It toast bread. What do you want?
Right? If it ain't broke. Gale and Salvor decide to leave Harry, but when they try and take off, they crash through the ground where they find an active autonomous mining droid, and they managed to evade him, both of those, long enough to fly back out to the surface before they're refined. And then they detect a life form at one of the statues. Gale says, somehow this is Harry, and they head over for his location. When they arrive, they find him, flesh and blood, Harry. They grab him and leave just before the autonomous mining drones reach them.
Yeah, I like this, like, little joke that pays off, where the is it the scow? What are they calling this thing? The crow, the raven, the scow.
The ship that they're in?
Yeah.
I don't remember. The raven was the one that Gale arrived in, which burned up in a sun, I think.
This is Hugo's ship, the Scow. I like the little joke they play where the ship's giving warning messages about the unstable landing thing, and they're like, shut up, ship, what else? And then, like, here, like, they literally fall through this hollow crust, and as it does, the ship gives them the exact same warning.
Yeah. I told you.
Yeah. I thought that was really funny. And then here's the, like, you know, Harry gives the enigmatic uninhabited does not mean alone. And now, because these things are starting to wake up and they're going ape shit.
Why do you think they're waking up right now? Is it just programmed to detect things, life around them and attack it?
It must detect biofields, you know, whatever Hober Mallow was talking about, having to put gems in his mouth because it's his biofield surrounds it. Because I don't know. unless it's Kale doing it, like, you know, giving them some kind of artificial crisis. Like, I don't know what else would cause them to hightail it to the... Although there's also this funny line, I thought, where Gale and Salvor is like, once they get into, you know, I don't know, 1,000 feet off the ground or whatever, they're like, did we shake them? I'm like, can these things take off? Like, I think once get, you know, probably 300 feet in the air, you're safe. But maybe not.
Yeah.
But then
maybe they these got things, lasers. I don't know.
It's true. They do have lasers. They can swim through rock like a sandworm and dune.
I think it's apparent though that they're attracted to those bio signs, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, if their final program was to go kill all life forms on the planet, then two new pop up. Well, they're going to wake up and try and kill them.
Yeah, like, this thing has two prime directives. Number one, suck palladium.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I came here to suck palladium and kill all
kill
life,
and
I'm all out of palladium. I choked on my own joke. Yeah, because they
are amazing.
They are all about the crush all humans
mm-hmm.
routine.
And that's it, man. We're left to kind of twist in the wind on what we think is going on with Harry and Kale and how the hell.
Kale's got this whole, like, you know, smug, my job here is done as the eyelid closes and, you know, she swishes off and. But mm-hmm. like, yeah, who are you? What is your job?
Here's what I'll say. Harry's ship was made from his body, right? Like,
no,
the vault itself was made from his body.
Literally.
So, yeah, it took him apart piece by piece and created the vault out of him and his coffin.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to imagine that you could do the reverse.
But she didn't have anything. It's not like if she had taken a prime radiant with her.
Yeah, she's got his consciousness. So, yeah, I mean, she doesn't have his body as like a blueprint.
Wait,
that
did
must be
Gale
somewhere.
Give, shit, I goddamn did Gale give her the prime radiant? Well, plus we know the prime radiant isn't literally Harry because he built it before he died.
No, Gale took the prime radiant back to the ship with her.
Okay. Because, like, right, I don't
he
know,
says
like,
it's
going
to transfer
what...
me out into this chamber. She has the means to support.
I don't know what part of Harry she would have used to reconstruct them, if that's where you're going with that.
Yeah, just his mind. I mean, the body, I guess, would have to just be wholesale recreated.
Oh, just like his mental algorithm is enough to reconstruct the body?
Oh, no. I guess I'm postulating here is, look, if you can atomically deconstruct a body, you could probably atomically... construct a body.
Construct it. I gotcha.
No, yeah, not necessarily from any part of Harry.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll hopefully find out more about that. I'm going to have a lot of questions. I do, so I hope that Gale and Salvor both have questions, but he doesn't seem to know. He's very confused when he wakes up, right? He's like,
yeah,
she asked him,
yes.
How is this possible? And he's like, I have no idea.
And that's interesting because, you know, we're always talking about sufficiently advanced technology indistinguishable from magic. Fairly sophisticated people from this timeline have no fucking clue how this happened. This is like magical to mm-hmm. them, which I think is telling. It's interesting.
Yeah. It's all ringing in my ears with him saying, you know, at scales large enough, I become insignificant too. Has this plan just kind of exceeded the grasp of Harry at this point? Is that what's happening here? Is this plan spinning out of his control?
Yeah, and it seems like it's all at the direction of the Prime Meridian. He's like following that along like a lodestone. This isn't stuff that he's wanting to do. It's what the Prime Radiant requires. The Prime Radiant requires you to be in a flesh and blood body. Interesting.
Yeah. Is there still a copy of him inside the chamber here on Una's world?
I don't know.
Or did they have to? Is this now a third copy
with
of
Harry? With
a
digital consciousness, yeah, you could make as many copies as you want. You know, I just had this thought of, like, one use of a flesh and blood body would be as an offer, like, could a flesh and blood Harry present himself to the Empire as, like, you got me, I've been off being worshipped as a prophet in cryosleep for several generations, but you're really applying a pressure to us, and it's time for me to hand myself in. He's like a sacrificial lamb, a scapegoat.
Sacrificial Harry, yeah. I could see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or he could be like, oh, I've been, because why haven't you aged 163 years? Well, I've been taking a page off of your book and I've been cloning myself over. I could, that'd be an interesting possibility. I could see, because the crisis is the Empire's coming for them now. They got their best general doing recon. He's got a big fleet. Maybe the Foundation's ready to take him on. Maybe they're not. But there's got to be a way through this crisis. And maybe, yes, offering himself up as a Trojan horse type of sacrifice would be the way to go.
Could be.
Anyway,
I can also see this being, I asked, what would Harry do? The root of that is, what would Jesus do? I could see this being a resurrection style, prophet God sort of thing that could happen here if he were to show up in Terminus. Boy, that would restore the faith of a lot of people real quick, right?
True.
Especially because the vault has opened, but not shown. Harry has not shown his face there. This could be set up for that.
Yeah, you could have like a Christ Antichrist. Like, you got the good Harry versus the evil Harry. You could go with like a Trinity. Uh-huh. Like, if Callie's made a copy of him, and you got a flesh and blood one, and that even kind of, you got the God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, God the Son. He's made flesh again. There's a lot of interesting Judeo-Christian mythic areas they could go down with this path. We're so far off the literal page. It's like, I feel like I can speculate to my heart's content on these things.
Of course. The thing that I love about it, though, is there's no way to point at this and be like, oh, this isn't realistic. Like, that technology is stupid, because so much of this has been magical, practically magical, but based in science anyway.
Yeah,
so now you're just like, yeah, they could bring Harry back in a human body.
Not
Why
a
not?
Single problem with that. No, yeah.
Nope. So I don't know. It's super interesting, and I'm very excited to see next episode.
Is that it for the episode? This episode?
It is. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you would like to send us feedback, it's easy to do so. foundation@baldmove.com. Don't forget to add the Goyer to your subject line if it's a particular question for him, because these are things I'm going to have to save up until we talk to him, if we end up getting lucky enough to talk to him. foundation@baldmove.com.
You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast.
All right, first up is David. He says, regarding episode 2 in the market scene with Brother Constant and the old man, just as Constant walks into market, we see a shot of the old man touch his temple and there's a red flash in his eye. We go back to episode 1 when Demerzel is briefing the Kleons. She mentions rumors from the edge about... Got to enunciate that. Got to enunciate, or it sounds like Klingon. Kleon, Klingon. Kleon, Klingon. It's a vocal warm-up I like to do before Foundation.
Yeah.
And Strange New Worlds. But as she's briefing the Kleons, she mentions rumors from the edge about magicians who glow and fly and are pervious to weapons. They decide to do some intel gathering before attacking. My guess is this old man is a spy for the Empire, and he's going to see what they have shield and jump technology, both of which would represent a major threat to the Empire. No, you're 100% correct.
So Empire abandons the planet but leaves spies behind. Smart.
Yeah, and we see this episode. They don't leave them entirely to their own devices. You wonder why it's taken this long for the Empire to kind of cotton anything or to cotton on to anything,
right? Yeah, and why it feels like they're completely in the dark what's happening in the Outer Rim or Outer Reach.
But like also, if you hear about magicians who fly and grow around or tricksters, like, do you automatically associate them with the Foundation? And I guess also the lot on Empire's mind,
Yep.
In the last 100 years or so. So, but no, good spot with the eye camera. Zach says, I'm thinking that technological progress and Foundation has been stifled by the Empire. This is with our discussion about, you know, how technological stasis can sometimes happen in these far-flung futures.
Mm-hmm.
I think the tech progress and Foundation has been stifled by the Empire, especially long-distance spaceflight. If spaceflight requires a special person to pilot and guide the ships and only Empire has that knowledge, they control shipping and the ability to conduct interstellar warfare. Perhaps there's some changes in tech in other areas, but the ability to control long-distance spaceflight would reduce threats to the Empire. I suppose an invading army could go to cryosleep for 200 years to get to Trantor, but how long can a person stay mad enough to kill and die?
Well, I mean, if you go to sleep mad, you probably wake up mad.
True.
I get your point. In 200 years, I guess you'd really have to repress the technological advancement to not have... you know, essentially magical weapons once they show up 200 years later, right?
Yeah, that's actually a plot point that they develop in the Three Body Problem series, is like, if you launch a battle fleet to conquer your neighbors and it takes 500 years to get there and you're showing up a 500-year-old technology and it's curb stomp, you know, like...
Uh-huh, totally.
You got lasers and they got turbo lasers, or you got nuclear weapons and they got photon torpedoes.
You're the Ewoks and they're the Empire, yeah.
Exactly.
Wait a
exactly. But I think, it does seem that, like, it wouldn't be as big a deal because there's just not that much... change that's happening.
Uh-huh.
You also, like, if you go to cryosleep to do an invasion fleet, you also give them 200 years to find you and fuck with you in flight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if people can even be tracked and molested inside hyperspace travel. Like, you're not in the universe
anymore. That's a good question. Yeah. You kind of just appear where at your destination, right? So, like, probably not, but in that case, you wouldn't be in hyperspace or warp or whatever they want to call it.
And I think you spend some... I don't think it's instantaneous. I do think you open up the wormhole and then you spend some amount of time. It's not clear to me, you know, because in, like, obviously in Star Trek, the way their warp drive works is you can track, you can shoot, you can exchange fire.
Mm-hmm. You match speed, you transport. Beam.
Yep.
And then, like, in Star Wars, it's always kind of styled that if you get to hyperspace, you're fucking gone. You know? Mm-hmm. You can't really be tracked. You can't be...
Star Trek also has the concept of wormholes, which is a much more, like, instantaneous thing, and right. a space where you could still, like, fight and fly and encounter other ships and stuff. So
true.
It does seem like they think you should be able to fight in warp.
Meet prophets. You can do all kinds of things in wormholes.
But if you're folding space the way that it seems like they're folding space, shouldn't it be roughly instantaneous? Like,
that's the thing with the whole, you know, folding space. It's the classic, you know, fold the piece of paper and then punch a hole. And it's like, you don't have to travel. That's just boom.
You're just there. Right. You bring space to you, and then you pop out on the other side of it.
The only reason I thought that it takes a while is because we saw Gale awake in transit in season one. So it's like that implies that it's not like a literal like snap. There's some kind of travel.
Mm-hmm.
But Greta Marie says, I believe one of Demerzel's primary roles is to be whatever the current day needs. In season one, the dynasty is threatened by Day wanting to let Dawn live, so Demerzel does what Day cannot, breaks Dawn's neck, and tells Day she's loyal to the dynasty above all else. In season two, we find Day more insecure and arrogant. Correspondingly, Demerzel's role changes. She's sleeping with him, offers him reassurances, and helps him work through his tantrums. I believe that the change in her appearance matches this change in her role. A thoughtful and thinking Day of season one needs a Demerzel who is proper and official looking. Her dress and hair, softly styled. Day from season two is edgier, and so Demerzel is as well. Her dress has this hard leather look. Her bodice is molded into a way similar to the blue chest plate Day wears when he's on the throne. Her hair, while still pulled back, is in a straight ponytail rather than the loops she had in season one. What do you think? Because I definitely seems to be a harder look to her. Maybe there's something into like the leather superhero outfit type of, I don't know about her bodice. I feel like that's always been kind of like molded to kind of ape the Imperial style. What do you think of this analysis? Do you buy into it that Demerzel's becoming the woman she needs to be in any particular moment?
It's really hard to see how what she's doing here is aiding the Empire as a concept. Because she seems to be feeding right into Day's plan to essentially eliminate the Kleonic dynasty. And I think that's really weird. She might have some, you know, alternate path through which she's approaching the preservation of that dynasty right now that we just can't see yet.
Or it could be her and Day are working an angle to, like, bring Dominion here to kill them. You know, this could be a power play and not a threat to the Kleonic dynasty at all, but he doesn't trust his brothers with that.
Yeah, maybe. Hadn't considered that possibility. This is all a put on.
I don't believe that, because I think Day is sincere that he thinks they're at the end anyway, that this instability, telling that he's maybe the most unstable of them, and, you know, he's like, oh, this is too much. We're going to have to, you know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I love about the show when I talk about the details, right? It's not just in, oh, how has the technology evolved and do the ships look different, but the characters are looking different too. And I hadn't noticed the Demerzel look change because it was 2 years ago that the first season came out. But that probably, says a lot about her role. Like, she's changing with the times, and not just with the fashion of the times, probably with her role.
She might have to block a blade with her head. You know, she needs harder, more armored dresses.
She might start wearing a helmet. Yeah. It'd be a good idea.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she have the
power armor?
Yeah. Why doesn't she have the shield that Cleon has?
Probably because she's just so, I don't know. It's like the classic, Tumblr post with the mushroom that says, you cannot kill me in any way, which would matter.
Okay.
Or I cannot be killed in any way that would matter.
Yeah, like backup, you might, like, backups and all that. Yeah,
yeah. Like, if like how would you kill Demerzel with a conventional weapon?
You know? I mean, then again, like, how would you kill the clones? You know, it seems like that might apply to them as well. I think there are ways to do it, but
when she says her consciousness is distributed, you know, that's one of the first questions I had. How distributed are we talking about? Are we talking about flash copies? Are we talking about backed up off site, off planet? Because, like, if you want to end the, like, I wonder, is there a second empire the way that Harry's playing in a second foundation? Like, is there somewhere off world where copies are decant, are canted and memory backed up? Because, yeah, like, you're asking me how I would end the Kleonic, destroy Trantor. I think if you destroy Trantor, now that's a big, probably a big job. But
they
that's
have a
how
lot
you
of
do
ships,
it.
You know?
Yeah.
For sure. And it's interesting to me that you brought up the Second Empire thing, because I think there is a direct analog here. If you want to say that, you know, Demerzel's role kind of changes through time, it's a direct connection to Harry in that, right? He's meant to be the guiding force for the Foundation, much in the same way. And he kind of becomes what he needs to be in order to get that job done. Demerzel could be the same thing.
Yeah, and there's also a nice duality too there, because, like, the Foundation is able to adapt and change because they don't have any, like, set thing that this Foundation has to be, whereas the Empire can't. The Empire has to always be Kleon.
Yeah, true.
Which makes me think that, like, Day is going to fail. Like, I can't, like, so let me ask you this. Do you think that they'll ever get away from the Kleonic dynasty before the show's over? Because I kind of, on the one hand, it feels like I was talking to Pete Peppers, and he's like, well, they got to. Because, like, this things, and they're going to have to come up. But on the other hand, I fucking like the Kleons so much that I hope, I want to see them go full on mutant hunchback or something in season three. I want to see how far it goes, because I just really have a lot of fun.
Well, we have thousands of years to get there, right? That's the saving grace, is we've gone 135 years or whatever. Yeah. And Harry's prediction was 10,000 years of darkness. So the Empire could be falling for a very long time.
True. Where, what? I felt like when they flash forward into Gale's future that they were heavily implying that the Empire had fallen.
Oh, you think so? With what?
Well,
just like
the
fire and the destruction?
Maybe the Galactic War had, for the Empire to fall, had well and truly begun.
I think that's part of the war, but there's no look, I haven't read the books besides the first book, and the war with the Empire doesn't happen in that book. I don't know if it ever happens in the books, but there's nothing to say that the Foundation wins that war, right? I mean, the Foundation could get their ass kicked, tuck their tail, and run.
They seem confident, but they could be, you know, they could, that could be a fool's confidence, because I don't have much confidence in the Foundation's leadership at this point.
Yeah, we'll see. But I don't know. It's all to say, like, I think we could see the Kleons really change over the course of 1,000 years, let alone 10,000.
I just hope they get to keep that the genetic dynasty is just, man, it'd be a sad day. Of course, I'd also be excited to see what they replace it with.
But it's the best innovation of this show, right? The best departure from the books, I think, that it's
up
come up with on its own. Yeah, it's amazing.
So Greta Marie has been waiting patiently for us to finish to get to her other point. She says, my more out there theory is that I think her purpose this season is to support Day. All while trying to bring him back in line with the historic Kleon dynasty. I would guess that her programming, since he must keep the Kleonic dynasty running, makes her focus more on Day. He's the aspect of the Empire with the most power, and Day is likely the person who can cause the most damage to the dynasty. It wouldn't be advantageous to just kill him, and perhaps she can't with her programming, so she sleeps with him, perhaps to distract him from the marriage, and she has the blind angels break in and show him the idea of marriage is making him vulnerable. So this is, I think, the second time someone has suggested that the corruption goes all the way to the top, to the thing that the Empire thinks is most incorruptible, Demerzel herself.
But that maybe it's not corruption, it's simply, you know, station keeping, right? Like, it's corruption in the name of preservation.
But if there's no chance to return to a stable orbit, then what?
Sure. And I don't know if there is. I think that's totally possible. I think it's a good thing that I really have no idea who sent these assassins at this point.
Yeah.
I've got some ideas.
And a reminder, too, because people... A reminder too that we are a show first podcast. Like, I've read all the books, but it was back in high school. That's almost 30 years ago at this point. Jim has read the first book 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, like, we're familiar with a little bit of things, but, like, we honestly have no idea where things are going, especially with as much jazz as Goyer and company are playing. Matt says, one thing I found interesting, and I don't know if anyone has referenced it in an email or not, is that referring to the three emperors collectively and individually as empire. It seems a very specific language choice to do this, and it makes me wonder if Demerzel's, in fact, loyal to the empire as a whole, but not to the Kleon clones in particular. Maybe she's behind the scenes plotting and making moves and using the word empire as a sort of loophole to be loyal to the person of empire when necessary, but also to the concept of empire in the long run. Perhaps she's seen that the person of empire is different from the Kleon she observed or their emperors that she has served before. And the events on the Maiden where she made to kill Zephyr Halima is only one of the many things she's had to do that we haven't seen that led her to believe that clones are vastly different from the original Kleon. Maybe she believes that either corrupting the genes or allowing them to corrupt or better to evolve themselves naturally instead of replicating them from the original body is the best thing for the concept of empire.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think they play with the capital E empire and her talking about the capital E empire in just that way to keep things ambiguous, to keep giving them wiggle room to do crazy things.
And I think each of the Kleons has a different or very specific definition of empire to them, right? I imagine the 17th here probably feels very differently about the word empire than the 13th or the first, right?
Sure. For sure. But I like the idea of Demerzel being loyal to not just the empire, but maybe humanity. You know, going back to that zeroth law, we talk about that derived law of, like, you know, a robot having generalized benevolence towards all of humans and then not act in any way or through their inaction will allow humanity as a whole to come to harm. And that's where you start getting really interesting moral dilemmas when you throw, you know, not just individualized humans, but the concept of humanity. And I think they're playing around with that. But it's also one of those things because, again, they don't have the rights to the iRobot, to the International Robotics, I think, the IR, all the different robotics plot lines. And they don't have access to, like, the third laws or the laws of robotics. So, like, but that's stuff that's, like, the Asimov, especially later in his life, wove, like, it wasn't, like, the Foundation series and the robots. It's, like, all of these things kind of got woven in into a larger kind of a universe. So... they're able to backdoor some of that stuff, but it's stuff that there's this hinting at. I think.
Before this podcast, you sent me a screenshot that kind of blew my mind, and I don't want to cause any dry pie here, but I am itching to talk about that thing.
Well, we are talking about it right now, because Jordan from Richmond, Virginia says, I'm not sure if you guys have talked about this yet, but Demerzel's robot repair kit box. So this is kind of like her, like, clutch purse, her makeup kit, her... robot repair kit. It's that jeweled case that she keeps to fix her face. I noticed it has a picture of Earth's solar system on it. I think this indicates that she's probably much older than the 11,000 years, probably closer to hundreds of thousands of years old. And shouldn't her relationship with Day be considered? Well, let's stay there first. I don't know how we get hundreds of thousands of years, because honestly, I don't know how far in the future we are from our time.
I don't either. You can tell me it's 3,000 to 5,000 years, and I would certainly believe it.
If you look at this image, there is what's obviously a representation of the sun, and then there's 8 jewels, and they're all painted to look like the third one's clearly Earth, the fifth one's clearly Jupiter.
They're all sized
clearly...
too. It's yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all sized, they're in the right order. And it's my impression of the universe as it is that the soul system, Earth, the sun, all those things are almost mythological places at this point. Like, Trantor is not Earth. I don't think so.
No. I assumed it was not Earth. Yeah.
Because it's got a different name and all that. And I think, like, is there an odd number? Like, I'm trying to think of, like, from what we've seen of its solar system, is there anything we could do to rule it out either? Or, but yeah, no, this is, this is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I'm not sure it says that she's potentially much, much older. What it might say is she's been around before even the two regimes that we know of, right? You've got the Cleonic dynasty and you've got the empire before that, which she predates both of those.
Yeah, she's pre-imperial technology.
Like, what is she, a Boston Dynamics robot that, like, they finally perfected that and Demerzel's the result?
Yeah.
Did she come out of some MIT lab somewhere? I don't know.
Yeah, she's the dancing robot.
But it's super weird, right? Because they've never even hinted that we are in our solar system here.
Yeah, no, man, it's funny you say Boston Dynamics, but that would be a really fucking cool idea. I like when they play with that. Like, you know how they did in 2001 when Hal was dying, he goes out singing Daisy, which was one of the very first IBM supercomputer demo things that they did.
Nice.
That grind its hard disk drives or its tape drives to make that sound. That sound. That would be cool. I'm not like it'd be really funny. Like, I can see this, like, montage in season 5 of Demerzel thinking about the sweep of her life, and it starts off with some nerds in a lab trying to shove her over as she's walking over boxes and trying to go upstairs. Yeah. And there's guys, like, 'cause you've seen that, like, guys at Boston just drop kicking the robots and trying to make them fall. And then she goes from that to, like, walking the spiral, and that'd be cool.
Oh yeah, if the spiral was actually just, like, one of the tests they did and it turned into a religion eventually,
right?
That'd be weird. But yeah, so its implications are interesting, right? If she is 11,000 years old and a product of the solar system of Earth, like, where do her loyalties lie? Is there something older than both of these empires that we know of that really set her on her trajectory? And now she's just kind of fulfilling that promise.
It's Cthulhu. Eventually all goes back to the great old ones, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
Let's move on. So keep your eyes peeled for more revelations about Demerzel's ancientness, but we'll move on to David Hood, who says, in regards to the Foundation using religion as a tool to promote their ideas, is a pretty common theory in the 50s and 60s science fiction. The fact that you think of Scientology, the fact that you thought of Scientology is not a stretch. Obviously, L. Ron Hubbard was steeped in the science fiction community, and if you look at this text and Hubbard's text when Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land, they all feature this theme that you must teach science and philosophy through religion. The masses with mythologize. Got it. Almost went off went through the safety barrier. Stayed between the lines. The masses with mythologize science anyway. This way it can be controlled. Yeah, I think this goes back to, like, you know, communism. You know, religion is the opiate of the masses, kind of, like, this was the big idea, the big threatening idea at the time, and they were clearly playing with it. I don't know if it goes beyond that, but clearly in 2023 we're in a different place when it comes to, you know, religion and secularism and things like that. But yeah, no, I think it seems obvious why Asimov would be fascinated with that idea. So it
makes a lot of sense in the development of a civilization too, and I think that's one of the larger things he's getting at, right? Is how does a new civilization develop from scratch?
Yeah. Finally, if this is truly a metaphor for the fall of the Roman Empire, it could be argued the Catholic Church held Europe together until the Renaissance. The Church maintained a library of pre-collapse literature, and monks diligently copied every scrap of paper they could get their hands on. In this way, religion saved the contents of civilization until people are able to read Plato and Aristotle once again. An interesting take on things, too.
Yeah, I mean, they do some preservation work, for sure. Or did. I don't know about now. It's one of many facets of what religion did then, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you never know. You never know how your culture is going to be preserved. Let's move on to Alvin, who says, I'm not precious about a lot of adaptations and adapted works. However, Asimov and Vonnegut, two authors I am precious about. I read the Foundation series about 5 years ago, already a grown-ass man. With 35 years of experience with visual language, I could not possibly envision the world Apple and Goyer have created. It's gorgeous. I think a lot of adaptations don't work because people have a vision in their heads of what an author's world looks like and are disappointed it doesn't look like what they've imagined. Also, as much as I love Foundation, it has its flaws, and I think the show is fixing some of it, i.e. a more cohesive story. I think there's a chance to be a better sci-fi adaptation than The Expanse. Whoa. Not talking about the overall product, because The Expanse might be the best science fiction show ever, but how well do you think this adaptation is going to be? The first two episodes gives me hope that it'll be fantastic. What's your temperature on...
I'm encouraged.
How...
You know, I definitely had some quibbles with season one, for sure. But there's a lot of potential there, too. And I think they're starting to fix some of the problems that I saw. And a lot of it was, you know... Well, a lot of it's just taste. Like, do we really need action scenes here? And could the action scenes be better, I guess, in a lot of cases? It wasn't necessarily... objecting to an action scene in this location, but it just wasn't done particularly well.
Yeah, better execution, better integration to the plot and the characters. Yeah,
and I think they're getting there with that stuff. I'd say still not like perfect, and it's still not like blowing me away on that front, but the other areas it still is pretty amazing in. And yeah, I think it has a ton of potential. Look, Expanse is way up there on my list. I don't think you're wrong when you say it could be considered for all-time best sci-fi. So to set that bar for Foundation, I think is, you know, it's a high bar. It's a very high bar. We'll see if they hit it. But I think they're moving in the right direction, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that I think Goyer and his writers are really good at coming up with like these big ideas. I feel like Foundation is a good scaffolding because it's like a very bare bones. You know, it's got this big idea, not a lot of fleshed out characters. Some of the plotting is a little bit, and then this happened, and then this happened, and it doesn't feel really connected to these thin characters in a satisfying way.
Isn't it kind of like what they're doing with House of the Dragon? You know, you've
got this and then that, but they're adding so much.
Yeah.
Like 2 or 3 paragraphs will be an hour-long episode because it's just like, you know, basic historic fact. But, you know, you zoom into any. Like, you can read a 3-paragraph summary of the Battle of Stalingrad. Or you can do a 2-hour movie on a sniper duel.
You can do a 16-hour series of Dan Carlin podcasts.
Or you can spend your whole life studying it. Like, there's like this, it's one of those things where you can zoom in and out, and like the Foundation is written from the perspective of being way to hell zoomed out. And it's like, I think it's a really perfect scaffold for them to plug those ideas, like, ooh, Cleonic Dynasty. And, and you know, also, Foundation has a lot of like this stuff about the Foundation morphing into a quasi religion is right out of the book. So if you're liking that, that's like original. If you like the Cleonic Dynasty, that's a Goyer kind of thing. But I'm very pleased. You know, I would forgive a hell of a lot just to get the visuals of this show.
That's the thing. They've already created, I don't know, an expanse, a time. An all-time great-looking sci-fi show. Even if this show turned into trash tomorrow, all downhill past next episode, I'd be like, well, they still made this beautiful work of art.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm prepared to forgive a lot for the visuals and the sci-fi, you know, goodness of this show, but I feel like I haven't really had to sacrifice much. You know? Like, I'm not really overlooking a lot.
The last show I felt that way about was... That Ridley Scott, Wolves, what was it? Raised by Wolves. That was kind of a beautiful show in its own way, and it had some interesting ideas, but its execution, I thought, was very bad.
It didn't quite, wasn't ever quite able to cohese enough for me to want to know what... I made it through the first season, but I never got into the second, and I think I got canceled after that. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, you can be good-looking in an empty suit,
I don't think this show is
going
that,
on
for sure.
In between the years, but yeah, I don't. That's not this show. Mm-hmm. Finally, this is a little bit of a tangent, but we're still in badass mode here at Bald Move, celebrating our badass fest. He says, "I'm catching up on your badass content since I've become a club member." Well, thank you. Thank you for your support. "My boy Lee Pace has got to be at least a 1.94C badass, right? The second he pulled up in the regal ass elk in the Hobbit movies, he won me over. Granted, his character is split into three and done well by two other actors, but his portrayal of Dawn and Thranduil at least put him in consideration territory." I think Lee Pace is on our list to be considered, his badass status rated and considered, but I think he's got more than those roles, too. Because he was also Ronan the Accuser in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. Possessor of I mean, that's fucking badass. And the dude is like a god. He is like 6 foot six and looking the way he does naked. I think he would make a lot of noise.
Yeah, for sure.
Probably somewhere in between. I'm guessing a 1.75 to 2.25.
But I don't know if you're gonna convince me with the Hobbit movies, because those are garbage. And I watched.
I don't count. I,
quote unquote, watched them.
He is portrayed as the elf king. He's a badass.
Probably a badass. I don't know, because I don't remember him in those at all.
Yeah, maybe next year we'll get around to sorting him.
All I remember of those movies is a 60 minute dragon fight scene.
You never watched a bunch of piers. Did you even see the first Hobbit?
Yeah, I have been in the presence of all of those movies playing on a television.
Ah,
which is about as close to watching those movies as I'll ever get. I put them on in the background and did other things.
I didn't know. Did you watch the third one? I'm impressed, because yeah. I think that's the only Peter Jackson Middle Earth movie I've only seen exactly once. It was at the theater. And I'm like, yep.
You went to the theater to see it? Oh, I'd put HBO Max or whatever.
Maybe I didn't. I just remember because I was contemporaneously reading my son that book, and I had just finished it like a couple of nights before, I think. But I just remember like, Jesus Christ, there's only 5 pages left in this whole book, and that's what this movie is going to be about. How in the hell? And yeah, it didn't go great. It's hard to blow up 5 pages in the 3-hour runtime. Anyway, that's it for the content this week. Once again, foundation@baldmove.com is how you send us feedback. If you want to follow us, we're easy to find pretty much anywhere on social media at baldmove, except for TikTok. We're at baldestmove there. If you want to follow with all the latest weekly posts to show what we're doing and like follow along all of releases. And if you have been with us for a while and you would like to get ads out of your life and you'd like to support our podcasts and keep us making more of them, we cordially welcome you to the club. You go to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can quickly and easily join to get tons of bonus content from Bald Move, as well as ad-free feeds. And hey, the satisfaction of knowing you're supporting people out there making independent podcasts. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Foundation. We'll be back with the 4th episode next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.